Okay. So two different questions that I want to discuss, which are connected, but you know, sort of different questions. And the first is the ultimate question, which is almost such a big question that I sort of, no answer is actually going to suffice to fully answer the question. But the question of the purpose of life, the purpose of why God created the world. Why would God choose to create the world? We know it was a volitional act. It was a choice. So why would God, the perfect being, choose to create the world? So that's the first question, which, you know, that's a more sort of abstract way of asking it. But to bring it closer to home, it's the same question as saying, what is my life for? What am I doing here? What am I living for? Why am I doing anything that I'm doing? What's the purpose of this whole thing we call life? That's the first question. The second question is also a question I think we can phrase more abstractly and then more practically, which is, God is a perfect being. God is perfect. And he's perfectly capable and perfectly good. And yet we look around this world and the world seems so imperfect. There's so much brokenness, and that's true for any time period in history. And unfortunately, it's acutely true right now. It's especially true right now. And the question is, if God is perfect, then God created the world, so why is the world imperfect? So that's an abstract way of putting it, and I think to bring it closer to home, to put it more practically, is just, why do things have to be so hard? You know, why does our life have to be difficult? Why can't things come easier? Why is there so much brokenness in the world? Now, that's obviously related to a question of why do bad things happen. I'm not really going to be addressing the question of why do bad things happen. They are loosely connected, but that's not. I'm not trying to tackle that issue. So if that's being brought up for you, so what we're going to talk about, we'll touch on it, but don't, you know, I'm not. That's not going to be the main focus. But it's a similar question, just to name that. So I want to begin by sort of setting the stage to see where we're all, sort of the background where we're all holding at the status quo. If I say, you know, the word God, so whoever is comfortable, when you hear the word God, what are the first, just one word, I don't want like a paragraph, just a word, two words, what comes to your mind, what pops into your head when you hear the word God? What adjectives, what characteristics, what pops into your head when you hear the word God? Anyone feel free to just shout out.
Omniscience.
Okay.
Power.
Mercy. Mercy, was that, sorry?
Mercy.
Mercy, yeah.
Omnipotent,
okay.
Underachiever,
wow, nice.
Well, that's good.
Make things interesting. Anyone else? Anything else?
Who's
underachiever. Sorry.
Perfection,
okay.
Control.
Vengeful.
Okay, great. Anyone else? Okay, so great. So that's a great start. That's, you know, sort of mostly the expected, besides for the underachiever. What do you say? Right. 13 attributes. So I want to focus on the omniscience, omnipotence, which means all knowing, all powerful. Omnibenevolence, it means all good. And really, they all relate to, I think George said, perfection. I think that the way we often, you know, sort of like the glaring image of God, which we have from, you know, years back, is sort of this perfect being, this perfectly perfect being in every way, shape and form. And I want to look together at a few sources on this sheet here, which I think will you know, spin things around a little bit, which will open up the possibility of thinking about God in ways that we may not have ever thought of before, or maybe we did, but to me, when I first saw these, they were really sort of earth-shattering. So if you look at the first source here, the first source on the page is a quote from the Zohar, the Sefer HaZohar, which says the following. I'll read it in Aramaic, which is a little bit difficult, but you could look along in the English, and we'll translate as we go. The Hakad Yisrael Avdin Uvdin Delo Kashrin. Okay, so when the Jewish people do acts which are not proper, not kosher, right? Kosher, they're not kosher. They're not proper actions. Kivyachol misyashin chela de kutsha brichu. It's as if they weaken the strength of God. When we do improper acts, we weaken, so to speak, God Himself. V'chad avdin uvdin de kosher. And when we do acts which are proper, yavin tukva v'chela de kutsha brichu. We in fact give God strength. We strengthen God. That's what the pasuk says. Tnu oz lelohim, give strength to God. So typically, that's kind of understood not literally. It's understood in some sort of symbolic form, but the Zohar is taking it literally. We actually give strength to God. Bima, how do we give strength to God? So finish the Zohar. Be'ovdin dekashrin, through proper actions, which are mitzvos, through good deeds. So this is a pretty wild thing, right? If you talk about God as this perfect being, this totally perfect being, then it's difficult to understand what it would mean to say that we give strength to God by doing good things. A perfect being doesn't need anything, right? The definition of perfection is I have everything. There's nothing that I would need. I'm totally perfect. So what would it mean for us to be able to give God something, to give him strength? And vice versa, and the flip side, what would it mean to weaken a perfect being? God is totally transcendent, totally perfect. What would it mean to weaken God? So the Zohar here stakes out a position which in my mind is fascinating. It's really sort of really spins things around. That we actually affect God. Tnu oz l'Elokim, we give strength to God. Okay, if you look at the second source, is a pasuk in Shmos. Anyone want to read this pasuk for us? Second source? Volunteer? Anyone? Frank, you want to read the pasuk for us? You're in my line of vision. It's like a high school class. Okay, so right, so you will know this is about Hashem talking to the Jewish people and saying, "I will take you out of Egypt. I will take you out of your slavery." And then the pasuk here says, "And you will know that I am your God that took you out of Egypt in order to dwell amidst you or amongst you." I am Hashem your God. Okay, so the pasuk says, I took you out of Egypt in order to dwell in your midst. And says the Ramban in Source 3, Nachmanides, Aval Rabbi Avram Amar. So he's quoting here the Ibn Ezra. Ki lo hotseisi, he's explaining this pasuk now. Ki lo hotseisi osame eretz Mitzrayim, rak ba'avor ki eshkon besocham. That Hashem took him out of Egypt for what purpose? It's fitting now, it's the parshas we're in. For what purpose? In order to dwell in their midst. That Hashem wanted to live amongst the Jewish people, so he took them out of Egypt. And says the Ramban, v'yafa pirish. And here's the important words, which are very, very cryptic. And if I didn't know what I was looking for when I had seen these words, I totally would have missed, skipped over. It's a few words, and he has here a total secret that can blow your mind. V'yafa pirish, v'im kein yesh be'inyin sod gadol. That if this is the explanation of the pasuk, then in this pasuk is a great secret. Ki kfi pshat hadavar, the simple explanation of things, hashchina b'Yisrael tzorech hedyot. The reason why Hashem lives amongst us, that he wants to be with us, is tzorech hedyot, is for our sake, for normal people, for our sake. V'lo tzorech gavoha, and not for God's sake. But then says the Ramban, "Aval hu ki'inyin shamar akasuv Yisrael asher b'chas pa'ar." So what's the Ramban here saying? He doesn't even say it fully, because this is one of the secrets of Torah that you're not supposed to say fully, explicate. So he doesn't say it. He says it in the negative. He says the pshat hadavar, the simple explanation, is that Hashem connects with us for our sake. And he doesn't speak out what the flip side is, but he's hinting that the truer explanation, the deeper explanation, is actually that he dwells with us, he connects with us, for whose sake? For his sake. You see that he's speaking out, he's not fully saying it, he's just hinting to it. The pshat, the simple explanation, is that he connects with us for our sake. The implication being that what the Ramban is saying, that the deeper explanation is that he connects with us for God's sake. So again, we have this concept that we're finding here, that God actually receives something from us. We affect God in some way. And this is a radical idea. What in the world does this mean? Yeah.
Well, he doesn't exist unless we believe he doesn't exist. So he himself may know he exists, but if there's nobody to believe it, he doesn't really exist.
Right, okay, but what does God care if no one knows that he exists? I mean, he's perfect. What is it, you know, it's not like some insecure, you know, kid who like needs the recognition of meaning. So, I mean, it's a good point, and that actually is a concept that we do find in many sources. It's called Ein Melech Below Am. There's no king without a nation. So that's 100% correct, but we could still ask that. It needs meaning, it needs further elaboration, because right. If God is this perfect being, so, you know, it doesn't need the recognition, it doesn't need the fanfare. So we have this very strange, radical concept that God get something from us. God needs something from us. So this perfect image of God needs to be slightly altered. Okay, needs to be slightly reshaped. So if you look at source 4, we're going to go back to an old source of Kabbalah, an old Kabbalist from years and years ago. His name was Rabbi Meir Ibn Gabai. Okay, he's one of the early Kabbalists. And he writes there in his work, Avodas HaKodesh, a fascinating idea, which again is extremely cryptic and esoteric and really not so understandable. But we're going to just see it just to see how far back this goes. And it's going to be a little bit vague. And then we're going to see Rav Kook is going to have an amazing explanation of what this means. So if you look in source 4, says Rav Meir Ibn Gabai, V'zeh loshon ha-chacham harav ha-mekubal Rabbi Azriel. Okay, so he's quoting now from the Kabbalist Rabbi Azriel, who was the teacher of the Ramban, I'm pretty sure, or the student, but I'm pretty sure the teacher of the Ramban. Shekibel mipi harav ha-chassid Rabbi Yitzchak Sagi Norhar ben Haravid, and he received this. You know, I'm going to tell you in a second why I'm caring to translate this part. And he received this from Isaac the Blind, who was an earlier Kabbalist. Shehaya shlishi le-Eliyahu, who received this third hand, whatever that means, from Elijah the prophet. Okay, why is this important? Because what we're about to say is the type of idea you can only have through revelation of God himself. This is not the type of idea you can intuit through man's rational faculties. It's not the type of idea you would come up with on your own. It's the type of idea that is, what I mean by saying, it's a secret of that Judaism teaches us, that it's something that was passed down through Kabbalah means to receive. Because Kabbalah, by definition, are things that we can only receive. We can't figure out ourselves. We can have human input, but they have to be received because of the very nature of its esoteric ideas. Okay, so he says the following. So this idea falls into that category. Hosif hashoa lishol, that the asker asked the following question. Be'ezeh hechreach tachriach sheyesh sham eser sfiros. Okay, so we're not getting into the spheros right now, but he basically asked, why did God have to create these 10 spheros, these 10 different channels of manifestations of God? Basically, in a nutshell, why did God have to create plurality and multiplicity in the world? God is one. Why did God create a plurality of existence? So he says, Kiritsoni lomar she'ein sham rak ein sof bilvad. Tshuva. So here's the answer. Ein sof hu shleimos mibli chisaron. Okay, the ein sof, the endless one, which is a way of referring to God, the endless one is perfection without any lack, without any need, any chisaron. V'im tomar, so you might then say, sheyesh lo koach b'li gvul, you might say that if God is so perfect, so where is his might, where is his strength? It's in the realm of endlessness, in the realm of b'li gvul, in the realm where there's no boundaries, no limitations. And you might continue to say, v'ein lo koach b'gvul, but he doesn't have perfection, he doesn't have might or capacity in the realm of limitations. Mechaser shleimuso. And if you say that, you're taking away from God's perfection. And therefore, God needed to create multiplicity in the world. So, anyone know what that means? Very unclear. What in the world does that mean? Okay, what in the world does that mean? Okay, so now, I want to look with you.
And why the yeah. Aim is Rashi Tevot?
That's a good question. I didn't think about that. What do you think? I don't know.
It's weird.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a good question. I have to ask one of my friends who actually knows Kabbalah, unlike me. Okay, it's a good question. So, I will try and find out. I didn't think about that. Thank you. So, I want to look with you at a piece from Rav Kook, which is just, I think, hands down, if like I had to pick my favorite and what I consider to be the most essential, I'm not exaggerating now, the most essential piece of a philosophy of Judaism, of understanding, you know, what this whole thing is about, this paragraph is it. This is just, when I saw this, I hope it blows your mind also, but when I saw this, it just totally reshaped the way I think about so many things, this piece in Rav Kook. When he's trying to explain, he doesn't want to see this piece, so cryptic before, is because he doesn't mention that he's explaining this, but he's explaining this concept. And on the back of the page, Rav Kook has just this amazing reshaping of everything. So on the top of the page here, quotes from Oros HaKodesh, one of the Svarim from Rav Kook. And he says the following, we'll read it together inside. Mevinim anu, we understand. Now these words are actually important, are these first two words. Because what he's saying is that everything we're about to say is from our perspective. Okay, we cannot fully, this is essential to say in a learning this type of Torah that we're learning right now. We cannot fully understand God. We can't. God is beyond us. He's above us. God is on some level perfect in the way that we all started off talking about. On some essential level, God is perfect beyond the human capacity to understand. But Kabbalah reveals to us certain things about God that we can understand from our perspective. So if Cook starts off before saying a radical idea about God, he adds two words which are essential to know, Mivinim Anu. This is all from the human mind's perspective. This is how we understand things. But God on the full God level is beyond us. So he says the following, Mivinim Anu, we understand. Beshlemos ha'elokis ha'muchlata shnei arachim shel hashlama. There are two aspects to the perfection of God. Two different dimensions to the perfection of God. Erech echad shel hashlama. There is one level where God is perfect on the level of perfection. You'll see what I mean by that in a second. Shemitzad godla ugmirasa ein shayach ba hosafa shel mala. God is fully complete. There's no change. There's nothing that you can add to God. There's no growth that God needs or can even have because he's complete. It's the finished package. Aval, says Rav Kook, im lo haisa ha'efsharus shel hosafa hayazeh be'atzmo inyan chisaron. Now here's the radical idea, this brilliant twist of Rav Kook. He says, if God could not grow, if God could not achieve higher and higher levels, could not develop, that itself would be a lack. We all intuit this. Growth is one of the most amazing things. We all understand that. We all intuit that. Growth is a value. The ability to develop is a value. The ability to work on yourself and get better and better. If you have something that you struggle with, to get better and better and to always continue evolving and developing, that's an objectively positive value. So if you would say, says Rav Kook, if you would say that God is perfect on the level of being complete and whole, and already a finished product, to the extent that God himself could not grow, could not evolve, could not develop and get better and better, that would be a lack in God's perfection. Because for something to be unable to grow is a lack, because growth is a positive thing. So if God is perfect, says Rav Kook, so if you're with me, I'll try and summarize it like this. If God is perfect, and the ability to grow and develop is an objectively positive value, then a perfect being must contain that value, must be able to grow. So therefore, we have to say something radical, which is that if God is perfect, he actually does grow and does change. And that is a radically mind-blowing idea that he's about to say about God. So let's continue to go with this. Ki hashlemos haholeches v'nosefes tamid, yesh bo yisron v'tanug v'ezem min ha'Allah. That the ability to continue and develop perfection, not to be perfect, but to develop perfection, that's a mila, that's an advantage, that's something that's praiseworthy, that's something that's great. Sha'anu orgim lakol kach, we all strive for that, we all understand that. Halicha mechayel chayel, to go from one stage to the next stage, to develop. Asher al kein lo tuchal hashlemos halokis lios chaseiro zeh hayisaron shel hosafa sakach. Therefore, it's impossible to say that God doesn't have the ability to grow. And therefore we must say that God has within God the capacity for creation and development. His havos ha'olamis habilti mugvala, the ability to create endlessly. Ha'olechas b'chol archeha umisale, that continues to grow and grow and grow. V'nimsa shahaneshama ha'olokis ha'atzmis shebehavaya ha'machaya osa hu ha'iloi hatmidi shalom. Okay, so we'll stop there with reading there of Cook inside. So that's the idea of Cook is trying to say. Anyone, feel free to jump in if you have any thoughts, questions, or comments on this. So again, if Cook's idea, which is a radical position to take, is that God actually, by definition of his perfection, must be able to develop and grow in some way, must have that capacity. Now, the problem is that to develop and grow means you have some sort of a lack. Right, but God can't have a lack because God is perfect.
And yeah. I mean, I guess in our language or our understanding, that there's no concept of infinity plus five.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So, I mean, but that's what we're attempting to
exactly.
express.
Exactly, right.
But certainly in our dimensional understanding of things, so, you know, there's...
Right, so that's level. Where this becomes... Right, okay, so good. So that's where this becomes tricky. So what if Cook is going to say, and we're not going to go through all the sources here, but I'm going to try and just present them to you on my own words. What if Cook wants to say is that God, by definition, the way we just explained, must have the potential to grow. Okay? He must have the potential to grow. That doesn't mean he has to be in a state where he's growing. He must have the potential to grow. So that means that God, theoretically, could be perfect without growing. But in that state of perfect without growing, he has the capacity to grow. Okay, now in order to grow, you have to have some lack. So if God wants to actually sort of actualize that capacity to grow, he had to create within himself a void. He had to create within himself a lack. Is this making sense? In order to grow, you have to have some sort of lack. So God chose volitionally to actually create within himself some sort of a lack. Okay? Now, put that on pause for 1 second. And I want to look at a couple of sources which are going to help us understand this a little more. And then I'm going to bring it all together to present the way I understand this. And we can try and work on it together. Okay, so look at source 8. We're just going to read this quickly. Source 8 says, Vayifka b'makom, that the pasuk says in Bereishis that Vayifka b'makom, who was this? I think Yaakov. Is that true? Yaakov. Okay, thank you. So that Yaakov encountered the makom, and Chazal understand that to mean God. Yaakov encountered God, meaning God is being called makom, the place. Rav Huna b'shem Rav Ami Amar, Mepnei ma mechanin shmo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'korin oso makom. Why does the Torah refer to God as the place? Very strange name to characterize God, the place. So says the Medrash, Shehu mekomo shel olam, God is the place of the world, ve'ein olamo mekomo, and the world is not his place. Okay, God is the place of the world, and the world is not his place. Okay, I'm going to explain that in a second. Let's read one more source. Lama, in source 9, Lama mitoch hasneh, good, this is this last week's parsha. Why did Hashem appear to Moshe in the sneh, in the thorn bush, in the burning bush? L'lamedcha, says the Medrash, to teach us, she'ein makom panoi b'li shechina. There's no place that's void of God's presence. Everywhere in the world is filled with God's presence. Afilu sneh, even a lowly thorn bush, b'libas esh. B'libas esh is filled with God's, with the fire of God. Okay, so what the Midrashim here are saying, as the tradition of Kabbalah and Hasidus understand, is the following idea. Okay, I'm going to try and draw it. I don't know if everyone will be able to see, but hopefully we'll be able to explain. Okay, so there's a concept called, there's different ways that philosophers and religious thinkers over the years have understood God's relationship to the world. Okay, we have this being of God, and we have this being of the world. How do you understand the two of them? Okay, so one is called transcendence. To understand God as a transcendent being, which means that we have a world, okay, so maybe I won't draw, I'll just use objects. So we have, this is the world, okay, and this cup is God, okay? Nice God, right? So this is the world and this is God. So that's transcendence. You have the world here and you have God here, okay? That's transcendence. Pantheism is another perspective, which is to say that this is the world and this is God. Okay, that's pantheism. This is the world and this is God. Now, what Judaism, I mean, I shouldn't say what Judaism believes, because there's a lot of different thinkers in Judaism, but what these Midrashim are explaining, and the way Kabbalah and Hasidus understand it, is a third opinion called panentheism. Panentheism, which means, interestingly, for some reason, panentheism is still not a Microsoft Word as a real word. Something that bothers me. Okay. So panentheism means the following. Here's the world, and, sorry, change that. Here's God. This is God. And this is the world, okay? That's panentheism, which means that the entire world is in God. But God is also greater than the world. It's not transcendence where you have these two separate beings. It's not pantheism to say that the world is in God, but the world is also the totality of God. It's a different opinion which says that the world is completely within God, which means that the world is filled with God. But at the same time, God is greater than the world. Is it making sense? So now, what that means, in another way of putting it, is that there's two aspects to God. There is the God that's beyond the world, and there's the God that is the world. Our world is a manifestation of an aspect of God, because the world is just in God. Think about that cup and the bottle cap, right? It's the bottle cap was just a part of the is in the cup. Right? A better way to have done the diagram is to say that this part of the cup is the world. Right? Meaning that the world is God. It's an aspect of God. But there's an aspect of God which is beyond the world, and there's an aspect of God which is the world. God manifests himself as what we know as life and the world, the physical world. Okay?
So what about before the world was created?
So before the world was created, there was just this God. And now what God did was that he chose an aspect of himself, which is still himself, so it's still within himself, to manifest in the form of the world, to take expression in the form of what we know as this world. Okay, but everything is filled with divinity, because this is all just an expression, a manifestation of a form of God. It's making sense? This might be total like fear, according to some, I mean,
what
to some
about
people.
The
yeah.
What about the Malachim? What are they?
What are they? I mean, the simplest answer, which is not really an answer, is because I can't answer much more than this, but it's just that they're different aspects of the manifestation. Meaning everything in this world is different aspects of this
that
manifestation.
Means
they consider
part of this world.
Oh, they consider part of the world. I don't know. I'm not sure. The question. I think my impression, my guess, is that there's some level of interplay between the two parts. You know, there's sort of like gradations, but I'm not sure. Okay, so what this means. Now let's get back to Rav Kook, okay, with that background. What this means to me is the following. What Rav Kook is saying is that God possesses simultaneously two aspects of his perfection. Okay? Two aspects of God's perfection. One is that he's already perfect. Okay? We can call it already perfection, static perfection, non-moving perfection, completion, being already perfect. And then on the other hand, God, at the same time, maintains a level of becoming perfect or dynamic perfection. Okay, what David Aaron likes to call it static perfection versus dynamic perfection. Okay, already perfect versus becoming perfect. Those are the two things which God is able to paradoxically have at the same time, even though they would appear to us as some sort of mutual, you know, mutual exclusive contradiction. But really, God is able to paradoxically have both at the same time. Okay, now are you ready for this next step? The way I understand it, is that the two aspects of God that we just spoke about, the God that's beyond the world, and then the world, which is an aspect of God, are those two things, those two aspects. The part of God that is beyond this world, that's the part of God that is perfect, that is already perfect. It's static perfection. It's complete. Nothing changes, nothing grows or gets weaker or gets stronger. It's perfect. But then there is our world, which is another aspect, another dimension of the divine reality, which is the part of God that God chose to manifest with imperfections so that he's able to grow, that he's able to become perfect. Not already be perfect, but he's able to become perfect. It's dynamic perfection. That's the idea. And if you look in yesterday, in the Hebrew calendar, was the Yahrzeit of the Baal Tanya, the founder of Chabad, Shneur Zalman of Liadi, and he talks about these types of things a lot. He is definitely working with this type of conception. If you look in Source 10, just a few words he has here, which relate to this, Source 10 says, Ihu mimale kol amin, God fills all worlds, visoviv kol amin, and he surrounds all worlds. That's exactly this, that's panentheism. He fills the world and he surrounds the world. Those are the two dimensions of God. The aspect of mimale, of filling the world, that's the aspect of God which is becoming perfect. The aspect of misoviv, of transcending the world, that's the aspect of God which is already perfect. Okay, so now coming back full circle to what we began with, our questions. Why did God create the world? God created the world because as a perfect being, part of perfection means to be able to grow and to grow, to develop. So God created the world, and this is going to address the second question also, of why is the world so broken? Why would a perfect being create an imperfect world? Why are things in this world so difficult? Why are our lives have to be strenuous and tough and challenging? And based on Rav Kook, the idea is that that's exactly what this world is all about by definition. Because why did God create this world? He created this world as the stage for which he is able to become perfect. And becoming perfect requires a starting point of imperfection. It requires a starting point of brokenness, of some sort of lack, of a void. So he created this world as an imperfect world, as the stage, as the platform for him to be able to develop in continual perfection, to become more and more perfect. And that is really the sort of the purpose of our lives. It's we are divine vessels. We are beings which are filled with divinity, and the whole world is filled with divinity. And every moment of life, every stage of life, everything we encounter is an opportunity to be able to develop the perfection of God and the perfection of this world. That's why our whole lives are about this. Our whole lives are about taking every chance, every moment we can to do something good, to do a mitzvah, to help another person, to connect and fill this world with more holiness and more godliness. Because that's exactly what the world is all about. That's what mitzvos are. It's hard to always have that experience in every single mitzvah, but that's what mitzvos are. Mitzvos are the way, the ways in which we are able to take this world which is imperfect and bring it closer and closer and closer and closer to perfection. And it's an evolving sort of journey and process. That's what this world is. That's what we are. We are the ways in which God is able to achieve that, which is an amazing, sort of very sublime mission, if you think about it. You know, we are placed here as the mechanisms, as the vessels for God to become, what did you say?
We're being used.
So we're being used, but the truth is, the Kabbalists take this a step further, which we're not going to really go into right now, but is being used implies sort of a bifurcation of two, right, of two different parts, right? There's the we're being used because we see ourselves as us and then God is God. But the point is we're not actually us and God is God. We are part of God. So there's no being used. It's all one identity. We are part of this divine reality in which we are trying our best to become more and more perfect and allow God to become more and more perfect because that's our reality. Just tangentially, this is a really sort of, like I said, this is a groundbreaking approach. Rav Kook, there's a very interesting, I don't have it here in the source sheet, but there's an amazing conversation. One of Rav Kook's primary Talmidim, disciples, was someone called the Nazir. He was known as the Nazir. And he had a conversation with Rav Kook in which he says to Rav Kook, and it's fascinating, maybe I'll bring it in next time, that he says to Rav Kook, there was an article written about you recently in a secular Israeli paper. There was an article written about you that says that you're very hard to pin down. He said this to Rav Kook, you're very sort of, your philosophy, your hashkafa is all over the place. You have this opinion, that opinion, but there's no central pillar. You know, sometimes when you have these big thinkers, there's a central pillar and everything revolves around it. And he said to Rav Kook, there's no central pillar of your philosophy. That's what the newspaper reported. So the Nazir, his student, said to him, is that true? You know, what is your central pillar? And he's sort of trying to push him. And Rav Kook said, no, I'm happy about that. I don't take that as a critique. I take that as a compliment. I don't want to be pinned down to anything, which interestingly relates to what I spoke about on Shabbos, right? He didn't want to be pinned down, boxed in, fenced into anything. He said, I'm good with that. And the Nazir said, no, but what is, come on, what's the essential piece, the central building block of your worldview? And he pushed him and pushed him, and eventually Rav Kook said, it's this piece. It's this idea. Why is it this idea? Because Rav Kook said based on this, that if you apply this to the whole world as a whole, it means that everything that happens in this world, which is a manifestation of God, and is happening in this world, what is this world? This is the stage in which God is becoming more and more perfect. So everything at some level has to have a kernel of truth, has to have an aspect at its core in which it is participating in the evolving perfection of God. So every movement that starts, everything that happens, has some piece of divinity underlying it, which got sort of contaminated, gotten, you know, it was sort of taken over and thrown in the wrong direction. But it has at its core a spark of something positive. And that's how Rav Kook was able to interact with all the things around him, all the movements, which were some of them very secular, some of them even anti-religious, and say, I understand that where you're coming from is somewhere positive. And yes, you may have, in my mind, veered off course, but you're coming from something positive. He was able to relate to the secular Zionists, which at a time, it's not just like today where it's like there's secular Zionists and there's religious. At the time, they were really sort of anti-religious. And he was able to relate to them and say, I understand that your Zionism is coming from a place of holiness. And it's veered off course, but I see that. He was able to relate to all sort of secular philosophies and incorporate them all into something positive. So this was the underlying central pillar of his philosophy in general, which I just think is an amazing thing to think about, relates to the famous quote that Rav Kook is often quoted for saying, that he says that the truly righteous don't complain about darkness, but they increase light. They don't complain about a lack of faith, but they increase faith. They don't complain about, you know, negative things, but they increase positive things. That's exactly this point. This whole world, our whole lives are all about seeing that everything can participate in some way in this evolving perfection of God, and that we are trying our best to capitalize on that and maximize the perfection and the goodness that's evolving around us. I want to just do two more sources and end with one final idea, but if anyone has any thoughts on anything we've said so far, feel free to speak up.
So mankind has been around for 4,000 years or whatever, if it take a little bit. Would anyone standing outside judging say that the world is moving towards perfection?
It's a good question. I actually think
I'm saying if a perfect being set up a system to move this part of things towards perfection.
Right. Yeah, so that's a very good question. I don't know, what do you think? Because I think that partially, yeah, I think maybe yes. No, I'm scared to say. I think yes. No.
Well,
I mean, for large segments of the world, I think very positive. I mean, think about, I don't know, slavery, right? I mean, you know, racial treatment. Not that these things are over, but there's a lot of, if you think about large world issues, you know, there's a lot of things that have. I mean, women can vote. I mean, like, there's things that almost, I think, we take for granted, but there's our massively incredible, you know, movements that are very positive, I think. I mean, there's lots of problems still, but I want to say one more thing about it, but I want to, yeah.
Well, I think the whole notion of perfection, I mean, it there is, you know, what you were speaking about, or what you said, like, David Aaron, you know, the thing of, you know, I forgot exactly how you phrase it, but it kind of is reminiscent of either like an art or an aesthetics, you know, the portrayal of perfection. If you're really portraying perfection, it is very static, and artists always introduce some sort of chaotic or sort of detrimental element to be able to offset the notion of perfection against the flaw.
Oh, cool.
Because you can never really...
Through the contrast, you can...
Right, it becomes very static, and then the flaw makes it dynamic.
Hmm.
And that sort of kind of enlivens it.
Wow, cool. So the other thing I wanted to add to in response to your question is... So first of all, I think in certain ways, yes, which leads into my response, is that I think that the way I've seen it in some sources, in some Hasidic sources, is that each time period has a different aspect of the perfection that they are sort of on mission to achieve. So throughout the course of human history, there are, in each time period, a different perfection that's taking place. So the point being that...
What were you saying?
So the point being that at any given point there could be progress and regress. That's the point. At any given moment there could be progress and regress on different issues. But the point is that if you take the sum of human history, you will sort of find that each generation has the thing that they did right, and that adds up to some sort of, you know, divine evolving perfection. But not that at the end, you know, you have, also hopefully at the end of end, you know, capital E end, you'll have that. But not that at any given moment it'll all across the board have been more perfected. So I think that actually, if you think about it in terms of what I was saying in the beginning, makes sense, because I think there are certain aspects of our generation which you say are incredible improvements from earlier generations. You know, meaning really like massively, you know, massive strides towards perfection. Yes, there are regressions, but that's okay. Yeah.
I think you make a mistake by making an assumption that our perfection is God's perfection.
Hmm.
That his interpretation of what is...
Oh, that's a great point. That's a great point.
You know,
yeah.
Steve may be right, but he may be wrong.
Right, right. That's a great point.
I mean, it's like, what's the famous question that Moshe asks of God?
Right.
And he says, what you may think is good doesn't mean it is good, in my view.
Right, right.
It's the same thing here. I mean, we can't define perfection.
100%, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't make a difference whether people have to devote or whatever.
Right.
It's whatever God is deciding, and we don't know what he's deciding.
Right.
How he interprets it.
Yeah, that's really Very well taken. I'm embarrassed I didn't say that.
But doesn't multiplicity also, you know, like once the plurality was introduced, who's to say this is the only version of a world? Meaning, if God is the sum of all possibilities, this is just one.
Maybe our world is just one of many. Right. Okay, that's just a little bit too twisted, crazy to think about, right? Right. No, I like that. Yeah. I mean, who knows? Definitely could be. But yeah. Okay. So I wanna. Any other comments? Well, happy to.
I have an issue with this, just from the aspect of before the world. It's almost like Rob Cook saying that God felt he needed to do this, but he has no needs. At least.
I was trying to speak to that. So I could be. I didn't do a good enough job. I was trying to speak to that, which is that Rav Cook's point is that God, by definition, within what he's saying, must have the capacity to become more perfect. So then it was that's what he's saying is true. Then it's a choice of God, which he made, to then create our world, to actually act on that potential. Right? So meaning Rav Cook's point is that he must have the potential to become more perfect.
So
it was a choice, though, to actually make that happen. So it was a choice to create our world. So does that answer your question?
Sort of.
Meaning he didn't need to create the world.
We're part of God.
Yeah.
We can increase his perfection by doing the right things.
Right.
And we can decrease the
right.
Or what would be the opposite? Diminish. Huh? Or diminish or degrade his perfection.
Right. That's correct. That's the Zohar we put in the first in the first Zohar. Right. Yeah, that's the first Zohar. Exactly. Then that's And if you look at source 7, which I skipped over, just a few words, Rav Cook says, "V'avoda zu hi tzorach gavoa." This whole idea we just said, that's what it is tzorach gavoa. Those words tzorach gavoa, if you remember the Ramban, that's what the Ramban said, that our mitzvos are tzorach gavoa, they're God's need. Rav Cook, in saying this, is explaining an amazing take on the entire Kabbalistic system. He's explaining where this whole thing came from, that we can actually affect God. He's explaining it's because God chose... Not needed, chose to act on his potential to become more perfect by creating a void, which is this world, which has the ability to become more perfect through our actions. Yeah.
So I'm just trying to focus on something you said at the beginning, which helps inform this whole point, this whole line, and that is that, you know, it's our perspective. So I think it's...
Yes.
That point's been brought out a couple times, so... And I think, at least what I personally find helpful in our perspective is that our perspective often we see paradoxes.
Right.
Not reconcilable. Because it's true, that's true, that we can't, but we can't reconcile them because we have a finite perception. And so,
right. Yes, 100%. So I can't explain this any more than I'm about to say because I don't know very much science, but when I was telling this to my father a couple years ago, the first time I saw this, he said, he thinks that this is a very helpful way to think about this, is that there's, in science, there's a thing that they have now that you could see something which could appear to be a particle and a wave at the same time, and that doesn't make any sense, but that's a paradox, that's true. So God could be fully perfect and becoming perfect, which seems to be mutually exclusive, but at the same time simultaneously, how can we reconcile that? We can't, but it just is the case. That's the type of idea that we're saying here.
Because there's like more to discover.
Yeah, or which might actually be beyond any possible discovery, but...
We just don't have the microscope.
Exactly, right. Yeah, yeah.
How many of our sages attack this whole thing?
Attack this whole Rav Cook? Mm-hmm. Many would. I don't know of any who speak it out explicitly. I mean, the Rambam is probably rolling over in his grave in this whole shiur. That you can't talk about God like this at all. That God, you can't talk about, you know, aspects of God, and you can't talk about God changing. And this whole thing is off. Now,
effect.
The response... Sorry?
Or that man's effect.
Or that, right, 100%. Man affects God, that we actually affect God, that can't, you can't say that. For the Rambam, mitzvos are ways that God gave us to attain, not going into that right now, but different things. Now, there is a response to that, which meaning the Kabbalists don't ignore the Rambam. The response is that the Rambam is correct on God's essential level, but Kabbalah has revealed to us a way in which we can talk about and understand God. So that's why Rav Cook started off Mvinim Anu. We understand. He's addressing there the fact that the Rambam has been accepted by Judaism as true on the essential level from God qua God, God's perspective of things. But from our perspective, this is revealed to us that we can understand. Okay, so I just want to close with a few more minutes, because I know it's getting a little bit late. that this is actually like an interesting pet peeve of mine. Sometimes people think of Hasidus as this sort of like just, you know, fluffy, inspirational, self-help type of movement that, you know, let's feel good, let's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And Hasidus speaks a lot to the fact that man and humanity in his or her challenges has hope, right? Hasidus is, you often hear Hasidic teachings on this, right? That, you know, no matter what, don't give up. You can always become better. You can, no matter where you've fallen, you always have potential. You always have hope. You know, in your darkest moments, you know, is where, you know, your strongest light can shine. You hear lots of things like that from Hasidus, and people think it's just, you know, nice fluffy thing. But the truth is that that actually comes from very rich philosophical ideas, namely this one that we're discussing right now. Because if you think about it, what emerges from everything we just said? When are you maximizing the reason you were created? When are you at your fullest potential? So like we pointed out, and someone I think, like you said, very well, at least for me, it was very well received that, you know, we can never really know. So I don't know how to say when someone said, but according to what we've said, when are you at your fullest capacity? When are you acting and achieving as much as you possibly can in why you were created? In which moments? So we sometimes think it's when we're thriving, when things are going very well, when, you know, things are perfect. It's a perfect, you know, picture perfect day, and we're successful, we're achieving. But according to what we said, when are you actualizing the reason you were created? When are you maximizing on your reason for creation? It's actually specifically in the moments where you are not doing so well. It's when you're challenged. It's on the darkest days that you're maximizing on why you were created. Why? Because the whole idea is that the world was created so that God could become more perfect. So the more imperfect something is, then the more growth is being achieved when you make a small step, when you achieve more perfection, when you bring light to that darkness. The whole world was created to have a stage of imperfection becoming perfection, not for things to be easy, not for those glory moments. God gives us those good moments as sort of, you know, rejuvenators, as moments to refresh ourselves, to plug back in and to get energized. But then our real work, the real purpose of our lives is specifically in the moments that are difficult, in pushing ourselves. When something's easy, that means you're not maximizing. It's when you're pushing that last little step, that's when you're actualizing your reason for creation. That's how the Baal HaTanya explains that there's a Gemara that says that you can't compare someone who learns something 101 times to someone who learns something 100 times. So he explains it's talking about always doing that one extra beyond what you naturally do. Because even if you could do something, you know, that's why we can never compare and judge ourselves, judge achievements relative to other people. Because it's all about what your challenge is. So for someone, it might be really easy to do something amazing. So for that person, they're only really achieving success when they've gone a small measure beyond that. And for another person, it might be very, very hard to get to what's natural for the first person. So for them, success is a much smaller is on a much smaller scale. But it's the same point. They're both achieving the same success. You can never measure yourself against anybody else. You always have to weigh yourself, within your own capacity. That's what comes out of this, because it's all about going that little step further. So if for you, learning something 90 times is easy, then it's the 91st time that's meaningful. And if for someone else, learning it the first time was hard, then learning it one time is what's successful. So that's what comes out of this, and it's all about your moments of difficulty. So let me just—we're just gonna look at the source 11 and 12 very quickly, and we're gonna take any last comments and wrap up. In source 12 in Tanya, he says, "V'lachin al yipol lev adam alav." Therefore, never let your heart fall. Never despair. V'lo yera levavo ma'od gam im yihya kain kol yamav. Even if your whole life you're entrenched in struggle, you feel like you can never be successful, it's always a struggle, it's always challenging, you always have to push yourself, and you never just make that breakthrough to be where everything is like you feel like you're just a good person. Don't give up if that's the case. Because maybe that struggle is exactly the purpose of you in this world. Vizos avudaso. And that is the purpose of work in this world. Le'ekapya le'sitra achratamit. To constantly take the things that are on one side, that are on the side of imperfection, and turn them over to the side of perfection. That is our work always. So it's specifically where things are hard that we can actually be purposeful and meaningful. And Rabbi Nachman says in Source 12 the same type of idea. V'hi ma'ala gedola, kishiyesh adayin yetzer hara ladam. It's a praiseworthy thing when you still have a yetzer hara. Don't think you have to conquer your evil inclination. When you have that negative drive, that's not something to think of as problematic. Why? Ki az yuchal lavod osa yisbarach im hayetzer yetzer hara daika. Because you can specifically take that negative drive and you can try and overcome it. You can push through it and bring it to good. The haimel hiskaber mitoch hamimus hayetzer hara. Through the yetzer hara to achieve more perfection. Lahamshach minenu litoch eiza avodim avodasa yisbarach. To go further and further in your work. Ve'imein yetzer hara la'adam. And here he says, it's a powerful thing. If you don't have a negative drive, ein avodasa nechshev es klal. What you did is not meaningful. Because that's not relevant to our world. Our world is about making strides on things that are challenging. So if you didn't have a challenge, then it wasn't meaningful. And you constantly have to be refreshing what you're pushing yourself to do. Yeah, any? I think someone, you and Nick Allen? Yeah.
I wanted to know what would be the conclusion of the years of the Holocaust that contributed to God's perfection unlimited. It was like a fantastic time for the growth of God by that theory. I mean, I don't know what to do
right,
with it.
Right, right. So, we can't know what to do with it.
Nobody knows what to do with that. It's a very tough question.
Really? I didn't think that was such a tough question.
It's a tough answer. It's an easy question.
So, yes, I cannot address that question, but I'm with you.
Yeah.
Because
when you say a world like, the more we struggle, the more perfection we contribute up there,
right.
That's the first thing that comes.
So that's why when I first was introducing this year, I said that what we're going to say does touch upon a picture of why there are bad things in this world, but not in any way saying that this actually will address and answer the question of why bad things happen. It addresses why the world has to be imperfect and why the world is broken to some extent, but it certainly does not actually 100%. But that's why I started off by saying that it certainly is not going to really answer the question of why bad things to that degree happen. So next time, Wednesday night, next week at 8:00, also at the Cantors, we are going to continue this and speak about how do we relate to the other aspect of God, the already perfect aspect of God. Here we sort of discussed, we said there's two aspects, the already perfect and the becoming perfect. So this whole thing was about the becoming perfect aspect of God and our work relating to that. So how do we relate and what aspect, in what way does that already perfect part of God inform and relate to our lives? So thank you again to the Wenix for hosting, and thank you everyone for coming. Have a great night.